Hello and welcome to Towards the Point. I'm James Sandy, and in this special edition of the programme, we catch up with some of the goings-on from Tongues and Grooves' 10th anniversary poetry and music festival that happened at the beginning of November. Joining me to make sense of it all is troubadour and chief minstrel Dave Allen.
Hello, James.
Hello, Dave. We had great fun, I think it's fair to say, at the festival. We got up to all kinds of things, poetry and music, and we've hopefully captured some of those throughout this programme. We did have some challenges with the acoustics, but we'll say a little bit more about that later. But we've also got some events and things and potential reading coming up later on.
We have got a potential reading. I'm not sure that I've, at least since I was a schoolboy, I'm not sure I've ever read any poetry publicly in my life, but I picked up this wonderful anthology of Portsmouth poetry, and more of that later.
It's very exciting. It could be your first opportunity to hear the young Dave Allen read poetry, but we're going to start the programme with music, and this is Dave talking to Nick Molyneux and George Marsh about their beautiful suchness of things.
Dave Allen, Express FM, talking to Nick Molyneux and George Marsh after Nick has just performed at the Tongues and Grooves Festival. Songs that, Nick, you've written musically, and George, you've written the lyrics to, and I'm going to ask you the same almost obvious question, really, which is, how did it all start? And we'll start with Nick.
Well, I think originally it all started with Tongues and Grooves, and I played some guitar there, and George read some poems there, and I think at one point I complained that I wasn't very good at writing lyrics, and I love writing music, and George has kind of the opposite problem, so we decided to get together and see if we could combine and produce something together.
It was really... I'd got some poems that, in a way, needed... I think it struck me as an opportunity. The idea of music and the idea of condensing something into a refrain and the idea of shaping it so that it would fit a tune somehow helped the poems come to completion.
Can we start, George, with any example of the songs that you've recorded, since people can hear them on the website and we can tell people about how to find that later? Any example of one that gives us some insight into the process that the pair of you go through? Because it's not Lennon and McCartney. You're not sitting in a room together writing simultaneously, are you? It one thing happens and then the other thing happens.
Sometimes then we are in a room together.
And just start with an idea?
I mean, sometimes we'll be in a room together and start with a riff, and then George will say something, or we'll start with a poem and I'll try and write something to it. So I think there isn't a set way for us to write a song. You know, people are always asking which comes first, the lyrics or the music, and it could be either, and it could be both sort of at the same time. Yeah,
it's usually both, in the sense that Nick will send me 20 or 30 or 40 riffs on a CD that he's done, and I've got a file full of lyrics, and I find something that strikes me as suiting the emotion and the mood of the lyric, and then I see if the lyric will fit the rhythm, and if it doesn't, I have to rewrite it, I have to rejig the line lengths and fit things to a different structure. And then when we come together, Nick tries it, he improvises a melody on top of it perhaps, and then we start arguing about whether it needs a chorus or not, and then we add in... and then he develops a phrase, and so then it becomes a collaboration, more of a collaboration when we're together afterwards. But initially, we kind of start off separately with looking for a match.
You did introduce us one of the songs earlier as being the pop-tastic one. So are there times when you feel that you are working within the conventions of pop music, despite the fact that you're working with somebody who's also a poet?
Well, that pop-tastic one was written by me alone, so you can see the slight change in style, that mine are a bit less deep than George's, because he tends to write more deep lyrics. That's not to say he hasn't written some good pop songs as well, and we wrote some for a girl called Christina who sings them, and they aren't on the CD, but we're hoping to do another CD with her, and a lot of them are a bit more poppy.
So what's the consequence of George's deep poetry in terms of how you come up with musical ideas, do you think?
Well, he does tend to have a dark edge to his poetry, so I tend to, I suppose, write in more minor keys when I do George's things, or and they are slightly darker songs and darker music, which is maybe, you know, his personality is a bit darker than mine, I suppose.
Is that a good match, George?
Yes, yes. But there is a very cheerful one that where I heard on one of Nick's riffs a tune that sounded kind of Elizabethan and like Greensleeves, and it chimed with me, and I adapted an idea from a Tudor poet called Sir Thomas Wyatt, who was in fact a lover of Anne Boleyn's.
And this is called Blame Not.
That's right. And it sounds a bit like Greensleeves in many ways, the tune, and he bangs it out in a nice traditional style with plenty of bounce in it. And so we put a kind of amusing lyric to that, and it is a Tudor subject.
Yes. So there are references there to historical ideas. What about your musical preferences? Because I can hear bits of ragtime in there, and we can talk about Greensleeves, which is very traditional. I know you play Celtic. I mean, does it just occur to you with a particular lyric to pursue a particular genre or style?
Yeah, I just do whatever feels right. And obviously, as you've spotted, I love ragtime. I love blues. I love folk. I mean, I've got a broad musical taste, really, but on the guitar, that's the main things I like, and a sort of country edge sometimes. So that's the kind of things I was into at the time when we did most of our collaboration as well. I was really into ragtime and blues.
You don't need belief. Gossip defeats it. It's tougher than grief. Don't add thought to the morning light. It is as it is, and it is just right. Don't add thought to the morning light. It is as it is, and it is just right. It won't smile, in war it won't weep. It was never born, it was there from the start. Quiet your mind, it's there in your heart. And don't add thought to the morning light. It is as it is, and it is just right. Don't add thought to the morning light. It is as it is, and it is just right.
George, you will know that I know more about music than I do about poetry, and so I'm happy to talk forever about musical genres, but I don't know about the notion of musical of poetic genres. Is that something that we could meaningfully talk about, that there are styles of poetry that you work in?
Yes, and I've been, I think, rather conservative in collaborating with Nick. If I were doing another CD now, I'd be more adventurous, because I've used basically simple ballad structures in the writing of the lyrics. and symmetrical structures with regular line lengths and so on. So I can see now that there are all sorts of opportunities for playing around more adventurously.
Is it sometimes constraining that you're you know, in a sense writing pure poetry, and then suddenly you have to find a way of working with another artistic discipline, another medium?
It's different. Lyrics are not the same as the poetry. You don't, in fact, because the music adds a great deal in the sense of emotion and flavour, and can convey a lot. So you don't actually need to be so explicit. As long as you've got a theme and a situation. Ideally, I like to have... I mean, I think the best songs have got characters in them. They've got a bit of drama. They've got two or three voices in them. They've got a dialogue of some kind opening up and a story. So once that's in place and you have some emotional refrain... The music really carries everything else. Mm. And sometimes with some of these songs, I mean, that one, Smiling People, for example, we were looking for, we thought, in fact, Nick was complaining, there you are, these songs are all too dark-edged and gloomy and slow. And so we were looking for one of his bouncy riffs, yes, that would carry a lighter song along and be more attractive. And so with that one, the lyric hardly matters, really. Yeah.
I mean, of course, one of the things one might say about quite a lot of blues and ragtime is that actually it's really quite uplifting musically, even if it does have dark lyrics. So that contrast can work quite nicely, I guess.
That's right, it does. It's sort of smiling through the tears, yes. I think. So that's true. I mean, in terms of the structure of it, we did kind of argue a bit sometimes that obviously George is used to writing poetry, and if you throw an extra beat in or an extra word, or you have a slightly difficult to pronounce word, it doesn't matter if it's on paper or if you're just reading it out. But if you're trying to sing it, and you're trying to sing a very high note, for example, on a strange vowel that ends in a, and then followed by a Z or something, you know, it's it doesn't really work. So there was quite a lot that had to be resolved in that area.
But has it solved some of your frustrations that you originally articulated on that first Tongues and Grooves night?
Well, it has, yeah, in that it was, you know, I'd never have been able to write a whole album's worth of songs in the space of a few weeks, really, wasn't it, the bulk of it, and then have it all sort of recorded and everything within a year, whereas normally it takes me about a year to come up with a song, really, so that's if I have to deal with words, you know, whereas I can write music just like that, you know.
Can you tell us, George, exactly where anybody listening now can go and find... Because there's a lot of stuff on the website. You can hear the songs, you can read your explanations of the songs and so on. Can you give us the website address and so on?
Yes, it's called www.darkislands.co.uk. Dark Islands, because one of the songs is called Dark Islands. And that one was set on the coast of Galway, in fact, Connemara Bay, and when I was camping with my children in a cowshed with no windows and doors, these wonderful old peasants cut down the rushes and we slept on the floor there on these rushes, missing my partner, who might have left the children abandoned, you know, and alone. And so it is a dark song, but with the image of the bay and the moonlight on the bay and the dark islands in the distance. So the website's called darkislands.co.uk.
That particular song's interesting because one of the things that you do, Nick, outside this collaboration is that you work with other musicians in a more Celtic style.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell us about it.
I also play occasionally with Hanging Tree Band, with Francis McNamara and Bernard McDonough, who will be playing here later tonight. And yeah, we do more sort of party music, I suppose, Celtic jigs and reels and songs.
Francis is a fiddle player.
That's right.
Who used to play with Dennis, who George also knows. I play with Dennis, and
right,
they used to play together. Yeah, I didn't realise he played with Francis. That's a nice story. I'm going to ask you about one other song, really, because I might have simply missed it, but I think on the website I couldn't read an account of Ocean Eyes. I couldn't find a story about it. Is that right?
That is right, yes. And it's a secret.
Very good.
I think it's too rude to explain on anywhere.
Perfectly fine. As long as I didn't get anything wrong, that's fine. Gentlemen, thank you. Oh, no, I'm going to ask you one more, sorry. So we can edit that bit out, so I'm just going to go on again. So Ocean Eyes is a secret. I want to ask you one last question, which is, are there plans for future collaborations?
I'm sure there will be something in the future, yeah. George has already sent me a few lyrics, and I've got lots of things coming up music-wise, so, yeah, hopefully.
I'd love to do more with Nick, but but he's a busy boy, full-time job, young family, lots of gigs, never, you know, it takes ages and ages.
It does take a long time, yeah.
But probably worth it.
Yes.
Thank you very much, George Marsh, Nick Molyneux, Dark Islands. Check the website out and have a listen to the music.
My guest was born in Selborne in Hampshire. She's a Warwick graduate where she read English and Latin. She's taught at the University of West of England in Bristol and teaches at the University of Chichester, where I think she's been there for the last 17 years or so as a senior lecturer. She was previously the winner of the Radio Times Drama Award for her radio play in 1989, and that's just one of the number of radio credits she has. She's written books Fire Play, Oxford Poets Anthology 2000, Hidden River, and most recently, The Blue Den. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Stephanie Norgate. Stephanie, welcome. Now, a number of things I read before coming in here talk about your kind of your exploration, as it were, if I can use that word, between dialogue and poetry. Can you explain some of that?
I'm not quite sure what that means. It's like to think of music. Well, in The Blue Den, there are a lot of sonnets I wrote that were the voices of aspects of the landscape, really. And those were all recorded and played in the gallery. A friend of mine and I did a 2-year collaboration where we walked around the countryside together and discussed all sorts of things. And then Jane signed out and had her exhibition of paintings from that. And I have voices, and I didn't want to display them kind of printed, although I did put a little pamphlet there, but we recorded them with different voices, and they played on a loop in the gallery. So I suppose that was a sort of exploration between the image and voice. They weren't really very naturalistic human voices, I suppose, but they did express what I think I was quite driven by anger, so I felt they were sort of being suppressed when I was quite sort of angry or not free or something. So that was part of it.
And a lot of your work, I think, is focused on very broadly nature, but more specifically kind of hidden worlds or hidden kind of things we might not see.
Yes. I did grow up in Selborne, and I did grow up reading Gilbert White's Natural History of Selborne. I did go, sounds a bit kind of spotty, but I did spend my time going down to the museum and playing there and talking to the curator because I was really hungry to have, a bit more sort of literary and information life than I had, I suppose.
And kind of soaking up atmosphere.
Yes, and so I did a lot of looking, and it does validate looking really closely at the things around you. So I think it probably does mean that I do go out and look at nature very closely, and I might be able to name things. And I just have a sort of almost like, I love the world, you know. I feel intensely, when I'm out on walk, I just feel intensely alive and aware of it. That's all.
There's a lot of crossover, I think, in terms of writing radio drama and writing poetry, potentially. I kind of, it got me thinking about this because I dabble in radio myself. And is there something there about the kind of focus or kind of the concentration? I find if you put a microphone in front of somebody, the world changes, depending on who they are. But you know, it really brings it to a point sometimes.
Yeah, well, I think working on drama scripts, you have to crystallise experience a lot. And you have to, I mean, by nature, I'm actually quite wordy. And working with directors and actors and so on, you do learn to cut it right back. So it has that in common with poetry, I think that's important too, that you want the, on radio, you want to have imagery, you want people to be able to see pictures, but do it within a few words. So I suppose that's the same kind of discipline in poetry, really, that a poem should form all sorts of pictures in your head, maybe from a voice that is quite brief.
Do you think that good poems can make good radio dramas? Or do you think bad dramas make good poems? Or, conversely, do you see where I'm going with this?
It's very difficult, that. I've heard some what I think of as over-poetic radio plays, I haven't really enjoyed. Where there's an indulgence, probably, in the writing, in a way. You know, obviously the writers, it's a bit like a really long drum solo, isn't it? In a rock band, you know. It's wonderful for the drummer, and it's a little bit kind of tedious for other people. I think the best system poetry and drama gives you is probably to be briefer, in a way. But yes, I think radio has a real poetry to it, the speaking voice, and the imagery coming by the speaking voice is really, really powerful. And it's not just in drama, is it? It's things like the Royal Correspondent, or, you know, when you're suddenly plunged into another country, and that imagery comes out at you, that seems really powerful as a radio.
Okay, well, let's move now to your first piece that you're going to read for us. And there's a really interesting context to this, and there's also a very local connection. So let's talk about this one.
This poem's called A Perfect Example of a Paralysed Larynx. And it's actually was me taking notes in the hospital when my father had cancer of the thyroid. And he had a number of operations, and he was in the QA hospital at Portsmouth. And we were going there a lot, and the title is a quotation because it's actually what the consultant surgeon said to his students. He said, "Come here and look at this perfect example of a paralysed larynx." And he was a very good surgeon, and obviously we were always grateful for that, but it was a very cold way of speaking about a living person who was in the room and who was fully compos mentis. I had a number of issues with the way my parents were both spoken to when they had cancer, because we were from a rural working class background, and they had Hampshire accents, and they were so talked down to by doctors and so on that I go to every single equipment with them and come out sort of fizzing with anger. On the other hand, we're very lucky to have, you know, my dad had 5 operations and was well looked after in many ways. So, you know, what are you angry about? So that the poem kind of tries to deal with some of that. And I think it ends positively about work, really, about the way work is quite an ennobling thing, whether it's my dad's work or the work of the people in the hospital. So it's called A Perfect Example of a Paralysed Larynx. In the waiting room, we'd stared for hours at the umbrella pine in a painting someone had put there to help us wait. The sky leaked over the moor. The moor leaked its heather over the frame. The purple light leaked into the wall from the open field while your ballooning arm leaped into the chair. The consultant's voice was clean and quick. May I take your photograph? His students, busy cartographers, gathered up their implements, torches, lenses, clipboards, words like block of disease. And there was your chest, pale as a birch and as thin, the blue islands, blue as pines, like a map some pressure of geography had caused. Of course, you said, glad to be useful again. Come here and look at this perfect example of a paralysed larynx. Yet you could still speak, and to me your voice sounded no different. Textured, lyrical, like a rough piece of wood you'd handle and plane or turn into shape. Forest in that voice, beech and larch and teak, a good bit of oak, some pine grained at streaming water, as wood shavings scattered on a sawdust floor. Months later, driving through woods, there's a patch of larches made papery and apricot by light, their evergreen shapes at odds with their orange needled leaves, and something of you has leaked into them, something you would have said about larchwood, some lost knowledge, some connection only I can make now, with the saw's rasp, or planks lined up how you wanted them, or with a student in the hospital, holding the photograph and peering like a craftsman at the blue islands of your chest. In the arc of suffering, maybe you were there with him, handing him the tools, advising, that long muscle of your voice, unbotched and clear. Probably I should say my dad was a carpenter, so that's part of the thing about the tools. And when you go on Victory, you see all those carpenters, the surgeons were sort of carpenters, weren't they? And they just acted like these legs with saws and so on. And so I felt there was a kind of tool-like connection between them.
I think what's really interesting about that poem for me, and some of the kind of reviews that I've read of it, is that it's a kind of an observation about the medical profession and medical language and medical culture, but it says a lot about how you think and analyse situations, or how you apply your poetry to kind of day-to-day things. Do we have a question from the audience for Stephanie? Is someone brave enough? Maggie has a question.
Stephanie, do you sometimes deliberately change your voice in a poem? Do you deliberately set out to write a poem in a certain voice, or, for example, you know, would you write a poem in an angry voice or a complaining voice? Or
I think to me I don't really pre-decide my work very much. So I don't think now I'm going to sit down and write a poem in a voice that sounds so. I have written some dramatic monologues. So I wrote one that was in the voice of the first Mrs. Rogers and Jane Eyre. I wrote one in the voice of Rogers, one that was really kind of up to the edge. So I do that. And obviously I've written plays, and then you write in the voices of other characters. But to be honest with you, I'm just overtaken really. Oh, sorry, it sounds old-fashioned, but you're not allowed to say this sort of romantic. I'm overtaken by the subject, but I am actually. I don't do much logical thinking, really, except in redrafting. So it's hard for me to answer that. It might evolve that I changed the voice, you know, and it became a dramatic monologue or a kind of persona. but I probably wouldn't have pre-decided it in any kind of logical fashion. Perhaps a bit more for those poems about invoices, aspects of the countryside. Like the song, the voice of a tidal road or flutes on a cliff. But I still think, I didn't really consciously think about it too much.
Is your default anger? I think that was part of the summary of the question. Do you think that you find yourself perhaps writing more about things that are fragile around us, or perhaps things that, you know, about the urgency of things? Do you think that kind of is a preoccupation almost?
I think fragility probably is, yeah, because things are pretty fragile, aren't they? So and like Robin surviving and killing things is really important. And poetry does help you to do that. And looking at the process of how it helps to do that in play is really interesting.
Okay, well, let's now move to your second reading, which is a piece called The Table, which I think is an intriguing title. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Okay. Well, it's interesting because Neil read The Table from somebody else earlier. A couple of things to know about this poem is I was partly thinking of a poem by Hardy's called During Wind and Rain, which is one of my favourite poems. And in that poem, there's lots of furniture outdoors, and you realise the whole family have passed away, and the furniture being out on the lawn, which is so disorientating, is part of the power of that poem. Then I thought about a table that my grandmother had in Selborne, in a little cottage she lived in, which was very, very basic, and she was very, very poor. And my grandfather was in the First World War, and he died when I was quite little because he'd been gassed and had gag in his feet and things like that. And so the table, and then my father was at war, and he was the only child in the Second World War. The table seemed to sort of draw everyone together through the generations, and to be this moment when I was very young and we were all together at that table. And it was an old indoor table that was being used outside. But not to sound pretentious, I also thought about in Plato, they talk about what's the ideal table, and there's the ideal form of the table. And I thought, well, it's this mouldering old, rubbishy old table that would be my ideal table, because of all the emotion that it gathers to it. The table. It was the round world of tea. It had a pedestal foot of mock walnut. It had been pulled under the bramley on the lawn, which became lawnless, where cow parsley and dock held the grasses in their sway. It was a plate of drips from the apple twigs. Like Hardy's, clocks and carpets and chairs, it was out on the lawn all day and then for years. It was a flat world of peeling veneer near the safe hedge of elders and elms. It offered nasturtium salads and peppery remarks, flawed like the internal specking of the bramleys with their sepia stains. Among the campions and apple blossom, it glowered and moulded and glowed, a green pool in a green light, suspended among nettles, its circle just visible, shadowed by the pink-gold towers of dock. When we sat down cards, the green world trembled and wobbled on its carved stem. I want to lean my head on the ribboning surface and ask, Grandad, what do you hear? I want to unfreeze his ear from the trench and see him listen again to the shelling of beams, the downy shucks light fall on the table. I want the people back who stood between me and death with their unlocked doors. Table, float them back to me, up the slope from the stream, through the hogweed, past the bare bean poles, till they're back under the bramley with you. Let your curved jaw stick as it used to, the handle gripped in their tired hands, then wrenched open and free.
I think there's something very warm and very affirming about that poem, and I'm not quite sure what it is. Does anyone have a question for Stephanie? Is there another question in the audience?
Stephanie, how does personal experience shape what you write? You wrote about a table earlier, you wrote about a personal experience. Does that shape how you write?
Well, I suppose it does, yeah. I don't think it's limited to personal experience, if you see what I mean. I would research something or find out about it if I was interested in it. It wouldn't have to be actually happening to me. But when you get interested in things, something's happening in your life at the same time, and maybe two things come together. And that poem's quite literary in a way, because it was Hardy, I thought of. And there's another poem by a Native American Indian poet called Joy Harjo, called, I think it's called Perhaps the World Ends Here, which is all about a table. It's all about the sort of life stages that go through a family table. And I know I did think about that poem, and I thought, mine isn't at all the same, but hers is a bit more abstract, but I did think it's such a wonderful subject, you know. So it's probably several things coming together.
Now, Stephanie, one of the things that you do, in a big long list of things that you get up to, that you're a poet in residence of the Otter Gallery.
Yes.
So can you explain what the Otter Gallery is to folks that don't know?
Well, the Otter Gallery is a small gallery that's connected to the University of Chichester, and it's on the campus there. And in about the 1940s, 50s, they had a principal who wrote lots of famous artists. They kind of have a cheap painting or something small that the college could afford, and they built up their own collection. And from that, they made the Otter Gallery. But now they exhibit that collection, but also lots of contemporary artists, NA students' work, but you know, a lot of it's quite hard to get on there, and they have general exhibitions. And for every exhibition, I run a workshop which is open to the public, and people come and use the artwork as a stepping off point. Obviously, it's not enough just to use the artwork. There has to be something of your own or some preoccupation that you bring to it. But that's what the gallery is. It's quite small, but it runs a lot of interesting exhibitions.
Okay, sadly, we're coming to the end of our time, but I must just mention before we go that on the 27th of November, you mentioned already, the Otter Gallery Workshop, which is happening from 12 noon to 1:30. That's at the University of Chichester. If you're interested in looking at Stephanie's work, and why wouldn't you be, you can find more of it on www.poetryarchive.org. And N for Norgate, I think, is the code. Go under N and you'll find Stephanie Norgate. Can you please join with me in giving a warm thanks to Stephanie Norgate?
You're listening to Towards the Point with me, James Sandy, and Dave Allen, and we're bringing you a special programme from the 10th Anniversary Poetry and Musical Festival, organised and facilitated by Tongues and Grooves. And Dave and I were very excitingly invited to not just record some of the things and talk to some of the people, but kind of get involved. We participated, didn't we?
We did, yeah. I enjoyed it very much because I met up with some people that I knew that I had no idea were necessarily going to be there. I knew George was going to be there, and I've known him for a long, long time. But on this programme, I talk quite a lot about art and music, obviously, and film, and one or two other things. But I've always felt that poetry is a bit of a blind spot for me. And there were a couple of things that lifted some of the veils from my eyes, James,
Are we awakening your inner bard?
Awakening my inner metaphor, probably. God, goodness only, I've no idea, really. But, I mean, I don't imagine for a moment I should start writing poetry, but it would be rather nice to get more pleasure from reading it, which I've never particularly done. And there were two reasons for that, really. One was I think meeting poets and hearing them talk about the work, and also hearing them read the work out. I thought that somehow helped me quite a lot. And then there was also this this book that I picked up called This Island City, Portsmouth in Poetry. As you know, I'm a pretty parochial soul, really. I rarely venture north of Fratton Bridge and never south of the Solent. So
I've seen you lurking in some surprising places.
but I am hugely fond about, you know, everything to do with Portsmouth, really. And the older I get and the more time I've spent here, the more fond I am. So I'm suddenly reading poems and thinking, well, if this was about Morecambe, I probably wouldn't, you know, excite me very much. But it's all about places I know about and understand. But it's more than just the content. It's also this idea that what is poetry? You know, why has this thing been written as a poem rather than as a piece of prose? What's the rationale for it? What's in it?
There were some very interesting crossovers, I think. And certainly a number of the people that were on the bill, if you like, on the agenda for the day, dabbled in both poetry and music, and yeah. Some of the folks had been, as we've heard, involved in radio drama and writing radio plays. And they were very much about not just poetry as poetry, but about narrative. And narrative and creative writing is a kind of separate spur or separate discipline, which, again, you know, something we've not really touched on in this series or any of the previous series. So
there were some interesting discussions. I mean, you had a discussion with a woman who's originally a Geordie poet who now lives in Hampshire, and this all happened in the week that we heard the news about the dockyard closures in Portsmouth, and she talked about, you know, coming from a similar home where she'd seen shipyard closures. And I had a conversation, she mentioned this publicly, but I had a conversation with her privately as well about the role of creativity in the arts on those occasions. It's a delicate issue because you can't turn up at a demo in the Guildhall Square on a cold Wednesday night and say, don't worry about all the placards, let's all go and write poems, because that ain't going to solve anything. You know, I understand absolutely about that. But sometimes, you know, there are ways of complementing political action and economic action and strategic action and so on with a creative dimension. And I thought, she said something quite delightful that's always been true for me of music. She said, if she doesn't feel quite right at the start of a day and she sits and works on poems and writes poetry, she feels better. And I always feel that with music. If I'm having a difficult day and I can force myself to just walk out into another room and pick up my guitar, and I'm not a particularly good guitar player, but just sit there and sing songs for half an hour and practice some scales, I will always come away feeling better.
There was a real emphasis in her work around well-being. And I should just say, the poet in question, the poet we're talking about is Robin Bolam. Yeah. I was very pleased to be able to do an interview, an in-conversation with her, but unfortunately the gremlins got the better of us and there were technical problems with the recording, which mean we could only bring you Stephanie Norgate's piece. But we have, I'm pleased to say, invited Robin back to come on the show in the new year, which would be great. I didn't realise there'd be so much tea and cake. Someone said to me just before I arrived.
Goodness me, wasn't there a lot?
I didn't realise, but someone said to me before I arrived, oh, there'd be loads of tea there. And I was like, what are you on about? You know, so it seems that, you know, whereas ecstasy and cannabis, you know, fit the rock and roll world, very much scones and tea are the poet's delights.
Yeah. It was Saturday afternoon and I was thinking Bovril and pies at Fratton Park, you know, but absolutely it was more, and it was subtle stuff that they were serving up as well. They were very interesting concoctions. Yeah, I mean, they'd taken a poetic view of kitchen work, as far as I could see.
We could have done a very interesting review, I think, on some of the jams and cakes, but that's a whole other genre of programme. Robin was talking, and you were talking on the day about, and you just mentioned it, that kind of creative response to something like shipbuilding ceasing in a city. And I found that interesting, that there were a number of conversations, there were a number of things sparking off from the festival itself. And I thought, well, actually, this is what a festival's for, isn't it? Yeah. You know, it's kind of pulling people together who have a collective interest. Yeah. It's the plus factor. It's the added value, isn't it? You know, like the live performance of something, you know, or a different performance of something.
It is. I mean, you've alluded to the technical difficulties, and there are some funny bits in my interview with the two guys during it. There were two floors, and there were two events going on at once. So I'm having a quiet conversation with George and Nick, and suddenly applause bursts out, and I'm thinking, I wonder what the radio listeners will make of that. And it was simply that there were awards for good poems being made upstairs or something, I think, at the same time. But beyond those technical difficulties and those funny flaws and things, there was something quite delightful about doing it in the Square Tower, you know, right next to Sallyport, the harbour mouth, the sea, and those old walls all around you. That you know, there was a wonderful atmosphere from all of that, I thought.
It was, yeah, it was a very, of all the gigs and all the things I've been involved in, it was a very strange venue, but strange in a good way. You know, there was something about the place that added, I think, to the festival. There was also some music as part of the festival, because it was a poetry and musical, or music festival, I should say. And you had people like La Cazou d'Amour, okay, a fine French band from Portsmouth. You had the Hanging Tree Band and others doing, you know, kind of quite different, mainly avant-garde things in the evening, which was good. For information on some of those acts and some of the people that we've mentioned and covered in this programme, why not go to Tongues and Grooves website, which is tongues-and-grooves.org.uk, or you could just Google Tongues and Groove. There's all kinds of things on there, and we'll also put some links to some of the poets and some of the poetry on our blog. Now, we mentioned right at the beginning of the programme, very excitingly, that since your school days, you'd not attacked or articulated, should I say, a poetic piece in public. And as we are on radio, what better opportunity than to give Dave Allen the chance to air a poem. And the poem in question is from a book, a very interesting book called This Island City, which is something you picked up at the festival and have developed a relationship with, I think.
I did. Well, I simply found one poem in it by a lady called Jan, who I've known for a long, long time, in which she writes about 1968, and she writes about going to a gig at the pier with the Pretty Things, and she talks. She writes in there about a light show, and the light show was run by two of my best pals. You know, two, and in fact, it was a light show they started up with one of my bands, so that they got their start there. So that was quite delightful, and she sent me a copy, typed out a copy for me, which is nice of her to send off to them, because one's in London now, one's in Manchester, so I'm going to do that. And Maggie Sawkins, who is one of the, you know, principal movers in Tongues and Grooves, she's got poems, and she's got a delightful poem about, I assume it's her mum and dad, watching a mum and dad on the Wild Mouse at the old fun fair years and years ago, which is a really lovely poem. And George Marsh, that we talked about, he's got poems in there. There's some haiku. I know that George is a bit of an expert on haiku. I'm certainly not, so I won't say any more about those. But I find it delightful because I keep reading things in it. Oh, there are also some kids' poems. There's some really lovely poems by 5, 6, 7-year-olds, really quite delightful things. You start reading them, you think, this is kind of a bit innocent and naive. It's quite nice, but it's a bit innocent. No, you get to the end and it says age 6, and you think, crikey, that's a bit good.
puts us all to shame,
yeah. But so I think people don't normally pick me out to read Shakespeare on here or something, because I have a bit of a pompy accent, but it seems to me entirely appropriate.
This could be the beginning of a whole new career.
This is by somebody called John Dupre, which I'm slightly confused about, because I know somebody called Linda Dupre who writes poetry and is originally from Pompey, but I think, and she's married to John, but I think this is a different John Dupre. I don't know about him. And it's called Portsmouth, and I ought to tell listeners that that is two words, Portsmouth. Much that's frightening about the English began and ended off Spithead. It is the blooded moor of England. You can see it now in monumental names and weighty pages of history. The gold-braided, pitiless glory of war won by unthanked spent lives, maiming and misery beyond tears. Bent old tars chewed, spat out and forgotten. Boys who never came back. You'd never think it now with its parking permits, light-flooded malls, poster ads and petrol stations the same as anywhere. Maybe it's best seen hazy with beer, or smelled at the water's edge, or heard in the silence of absence. Portsmouth, the mouth that snarled, now as always, sighs deeply for the passing of ships and souls, the flotsam of power.
The book is called This Island City. Portsmouth in Poetry. We'll put the details on our blog. It's been out, I think, for a couple of years.
Yeah,
that book.
I find it a bit elusive at the minute. I did find a copy in the Cathedral bookshop, but I'm quite determined to start pushing it a bit, really, and I've put it on my Pompey Pop blog, and I think it'd be great if it had a resurgence of interest. It actually came out first in 2010, and the publishers are easy. It's published by Spinnaker Press Limited, and that's, they've got a website, www.spinnakerpress.co.uk, and it's got a beautiful cover picture by somebody called John Everett. Lovely painting of a woman, a poet, flying above the sky in Portsmouth, and you could see old Portsmouth and all the rooftops and the Spinnaker Tower and a wild wind blowing, and she is flying above the city. It's a quite lovely little cover.
Just before we go, we've got a quick roundup of events locally and further afield that should keep you going till Christmas and slightly beyond. On the 19th of December, you can catch the Blockheads at the Wedgwood Rooms here in Portsmouth, £18.50 a ticket.
I'm going to talk about Pallant House, who've got lots and lots of interesting things on. Now, we mentioned Sean Scully, who's painting these abstract triptychs, and they go on until the 26th of January, and that's a fine show. But I'm particularly excited about a new one that's opening on the 30th of November, and it's going through December and January and early Feb. Pauline Boty, B-O-T-Y, pop artist and woman. Pauline Boty, who died in 1966. And if you've ever seen the pop art film made by Ken Russell, called Pop Goes the Easel, she's the woman of the four people starring in that film, and her work has been seriously neglected really for about 40 years, but is coming back now with a touring show that's certainly coming down from Wolverhampton and other places, and there's painting and collages and so on. And briefly, I suppose it touches in the same areas that people like Hockney and Blake and others did, you know, but it has its own qualities, and I think it's a very exciting exhibition. So that's Pauline Boaty, pop artist and woman, at the Palant Gallery, end of November to the 9th of February.
And from the glamours of Wolverhampton to the grandeur of Hawkwind, progressive, strange concept band, however you want to describe them, Hawkwind will be waving their wings at the Brook in Southampton on Friday the 6th of December. If you're interested in that gig, you can phone the box office on 023 8055 5366.
I'm back to the Palant Gallery then, and again I've mentioned this, but again there's a reason to mention it again. Eric Revilius prints 8th of October to the 8th of December, so you've got to rush really when you listen to this programme. You've got a couple of weeks left, and the thing that's really interesting about his prints, he makes nice prints of English landscapes on, but the thing that's really interesting that I've never seen before is that from a brief posting at the start of the Second World War in Gosport, there are images that he made in submarines, when he was in the submarines in Gosport, so there's a local flavour to it.
Bringing it back home, if you like, a bit more locally, you can go to the City Museum here in Portsmouth and discover Secret Egypt, Unravelling Truth from Myth. It's a very interesting exhibition and the kids love it, so I can recommend that one.
Okay, my last one from the Palant Gallery is somebody I don't know a lot about, really. Claire Layton. The exhibition is called Working Life. It starts on the 10th of December and runs through to the end of February. Wood engravings illustrating agrarian life in England, Europe and American South. And she lived from right the end of the 19th century, 1898. She lived for about 90 years. And the example of the engraving is somebody sowing fields. It's a very dramatic black and white engraving. Looks absolutely terrific, really, if you like that kind of rural feel, realist engraving images. But it's one of a selection of remarkable things on at Palant House Gallery, as well as the Nicholson family, which we did mention last month.
You might need a flask of soup, I think, for that last one.
You might do.
It sounds like one that you'd need that for. Coming up over the Christmas period, it gets into silly things, and some of those silly things include, starting from the 9th of December at the King's Theatre in Portsmouth, Sleeping Beauty is the panto that they're putting on, starring a whole mega cast of stars, including Daniela Westbrook of EastEnders fame, I believe, Lynn McGranger, who I believe was in Home and Away, someone called Tony Adams, who I thought was a footballer, but clearly from the picture, it's not the same one. If you don't fancy that, you can also go to the Groundlings Theatre, who are putting on Aladdin. That starts from Thursday the 12th of December, and they're also doing dinner theatre tickets, which is quite an interesting idea, quite a good mix. If you fancy a little bit more mystery and intrigue, or a little bit something a little bit darker, you can go to their Christmas murder mystery at the Groundlings Theatre on Friday the 20th of December, dangerously near to Christmas, and the tickets for that are £22, and that includes a two-course meal.
And we won't be back before Christmas, will we?
We won't. Our next scheduled programme is on the 30th of December, and we're already cooking up some delights, I think, to consider about, I think, New Year and how New Year's been represented creatively over time. That's it for this show. Dave, it's a pleasure as always to have you on the airwaves with us.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas to you and everybody.
Merry Christmas in late November to you and everybody. We'll be back on the other side of Christmas, but to play us out, here is a track from the Dark Islands project that Nick Molyneux and George Mars have been working on, and this is the title track called Dark Islands.
The open doorway rustles with a light dust fall as a sleeping wren turns in the old roof turf. The silence now stretches past the curlew's call and rests on a bed of whispering surf. Full moon sun's glow echoes softly from the bay and spreads through the gloom in the night frost air where my sweet little boy sleeps dreaming in the hay. She's a thousand miles away. Dark islands, shining water, have we lost her? Dark islands, shining water, will she be there? Dark islands, reflection ripples and there comes a sudden chill.
You can find out more information on all the things you've heard in this program on our blog, towardsthepoint.blogspot.co.uk. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.